This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security will come to order. Four bills on the agenda. I see Senator Pappas is here, so we'll begin with Senate File 34. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I'm supposed to be in another committee, I was hoping if I was here on time that you would take me, so I appreciate that. I'm here on behalf of Aragone House, which is a chemical dependency, what would you call it, supported living program in Ramsey County and Hennepin County. They've been serving the Twin Cities community for over 33 years, and it's a very cost-effective approach toward treating chronically chemically dependent men because it's more long-term, it's less cost per day. Like, their program is less than $50 a day as opposed to treatment costs that are between $300 to $500 a day. They provide a safe, sober environment, 24-hour supervision, three meals a day with portion control, one-on-one personal advocacy, and a weekly 12-step meetings, security around medication and supervision and nursing services. And they have a success rate of about 48%. What happened is they need an increase in their service rates, and they're asking for an increase from $542 monthly to $737 monthly for the Ramsey County facility. And why don't I let I have a few other more notes here. Then also the Hennepin County facility, is that in this bill too?
Yes.
Yeah. They are currently, they'd like to increase their capacity to 32 beds from their current capacity of 30 beds. Why don't I let Mr. Aragone talk a little bit more about the service rate?
Mr. Aragone, welcome to the committee.
What happened and why they're so behind the other facilities in terms of their service rate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Bill Aragone, and I'm the CEO of VK Aragone, Inc. It was started in my house by my mother 33 years ago. This is Joe Cuoco that's with me on my left. He is our senior director and also directs the St. Paul facility. Senator Pappas, you did a great job telling them a little about us, so I won't repeat those things. The nature of our issue is that back in 1997, as an association of similar facilities called the ASLR, which is Association for Supported Living Residences, we lobbied for an increase and received that increase from the legislature. Our rates had previously been frozen for 10 years, so a lot of us and other companies were doing very badly, losing money, some going bankrupt, and so forth. When the legislature passed this increase, Hennepin County gave us the full increase, and Ramsey County did not give us the full increase. They withheld some, and they told us if we needed more money in coming years, they would raise our rates. As the years went by and we needed some increases, they were not able to do that, and those purse strings, so to speak, were handled by the legislature. Then in 2001, the ASLR had lobbied the legislature for another increase. And during that time, we also spoke with Senator Pappas to have our rates brought up to the playing field along with everyone else's to make them equal with the rest of the facilities. And Senator Pappas authored a bill for the Summit facility, the Ramsey County facility, which was lagging behind the whole playing field. And The SLR, I believe, had Senator Berglund author the bill for the whole group of facilities. That bill was looking good, and some staff person thought that since the ASLR was getting an increase, the Aragone facility would not need the bill that Senator Pappas authored, and so they pulled that bill. And where the problem came in was that once we received the increase for the ASLR. The people who implement the increase turned it into a percentage. So We got an increase, but we still lag far behind the field. And so right now, the service rate is $737 and I think 48 cents per month per individual, and we're being paid $542 per individual, and we have the same contract as everyone else. We have to do the same things. And so we just want to get that equaled out. The second part of our request is for our Hennepin County facility. Back in 1996, a man named Gary Biskins, who is the head of the DHS, had increased our beds from 30 to 32 since we were zoned to be able to handle that. And so over for 10 years, we've been operating at 32 beds. But the current head of DHS was searching through contracts and noticed that we were not officially contracted for 32 beds, but for 30, and she demanded that we immediately vacate two beds. Well, that will be a pretty big burden for us to the amount of about $35,000 a year. And on our level of finances, that's a big hit. And since our facility is zoned for that, and Hennepin County DHS has no objection to increasing the beds officially, we would like to ask you to increase our beds to 32 at our Hennepin County facility. I appreciate you hearing me. That's all I really have. And if you have any questions, we'll be glad to answer them. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
I have a small amendment. There was a mistake in drafting on page 3, line 12. For 700 should be 740.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment.
Senator Berglund moves the amendment. Any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Further discussion or questions? Did you want to add anything? Or?
I don't have it. Mr. Chairman, I do not have anything to say at this point.
And so you're now operating at 30 beds in Hennepin County. You had to remove two of them.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Did they let you finish the treatment for the people in, or did they?
Yes, we did, Mr. Chairman. They didn't make us put them out on the street. They just waited for a couple of people to graduate, and at that point, we had to keep our capacity below 30, or at 30.
Is there further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, do you or any of the people in your group know if there are other facilities that are lagging behind the $740 rate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, as far as I know, I'm not aware of that, but there may be some. I just honestly don't know. We do have some leadership within the ASLR that may be able to answer that question.
If you could find out for me, I'd appreciate it. It's usually if we do something, if there's one, then the others come forward the next year, and it's better to know about all of them at one time and figure out what to do for everybody.
I would be glad to do that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Torres Ray moves Senate File 34 be recommended to pass, and this goes to your division, Senator Berglund?
Yes, because of the rate.
Okay. On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Take up Senate File 26.
Thank you, members of the committee. We are going to, Senator Marty is going to present Senate File 26, Board of Medical Practices Advisory Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, I would like to offer an author's amendment. And I believe Mr. Leach said that there is some, that this has to be treated separate from the other health licensure boards that are, so I want to repeal the sunset altogether instead of extend it. So on page 1, line 10, I'd like to put a period where the comma is, delete the rest of the section, the line, sentence, same thing on 1.13, put a period after where the comma is and delete the next two lines. And after on line 17, delete everything after the period. Same thing on line 20. Same thing on page 2, delete the entire line 32. Does that do it?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, so what you're doing is, in all of these places, it will say except that the council does not expire?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins. We did this for some other health licensure boards mm-hmm. in the past. And for these have been extended several times. They're needed, and I can have Mr. Leach speak to why we need these on a permanent, ongoing basis. And they came in with the bill as an extension, and I'd like to repeal it, which I believe we've done for some other health licensure boards. And seems to me we're wasting a lot of people's time coming in every couple years on a board that is part of their functioning. It's the Board of Medical Practice uses these advisory councils as actually part of their process, and it's an ongoing need. And we've just, I mean, they were extended several years ago. I would just like to try and repeal it, period. And maybe we can have testimony if you want to do it before we vote on that. And I don't need to treat it as an author's amendment if so. But I think it's a waste of everybody's time to have them keep coming in on something that's part of our process. It seems to me like we could delete the Board of Medical Practices and have it sunset it every couple of years and then re-come back again. This is part of their process. So I'll have Mr. Leach make his presentation, and then we can discuss which way you want to go.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Members of the committee, my name is Robert Leach. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. In addition to the regulation of physicians, the medical board is also charged with regulating five other healthcare professions. They are acupuncturists, athletic trainers, respiratory care practitioners, physician assistants, and traditional midwives. Because membership on the board is limited by statute to physicians and public members, it's necessary for the board to utilize advisory councils in its credentialing and disciplinary decision-making process. These advisory councils are made up of members of the various professions along with physicians and public members, and they provide the board with expert advice on professional standards relating to those various practices. because the members of the advisory council only receive a $55 per diem when they meet, using this method is cost effective for the board rather than going out and paying large amounts of money in consulting fees for essentially the same advice. The statutes which established four of the five advisory councils provided that they would sunset within a certain number of years. Because the board relies so heavily on the expert advice that it gets from the advisory councils, it's necessary for us to come back to the legislature every few years to get those sunset dates extended. It's not that we don't enjoy coming down here, but it seems to be that we could do something better with our time. I appreciate Senator Marty's amendment, which would essentially eliminate those sunset dates, and we would support that wholeheartedly. In addition to our advisory council, the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice and all the other health boards in Minnesota have established and funded a health professional services program. This is a confidential, non-disciplinary monitoring program for impaired professionals. It, too, uses an advisory committee in much the same way that we use our advisory councils. HPSP's committee is made up of representatives from all of the participating professional associations, and it too is scheduled to sunset. If Senator Marty's amendment is not taken, the sunset date for our advisory councils and for the Health Professional Services Program Advisory Committee would be extended out at least until the year 2015. We look at this as pretty much a housekeeping bill. We're not aware of any opposition to the bill. And once again, we appreciate your time, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions that you have.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Mr. Leach, at the end of every legislative session, a whole lot of stuff falls out of my brain, but I remember that we have had bills in the past dealing with some prescription drug monitoring. We called it NASPR, and that the Board of Medical Practice was actively lobbying against this bill. Do I remember that correctly? And can you remind me why?
Senator Higgins, yes, the Board of Medical Practice has voted to oppose that bill last year, and has voted once again this year to oppose it if it comes to the table here in this session.
Is that common, Madam Chair, Mr. Leach, that the board has an active role in promoting or trying to kill legislation? Is that part of the board's role?
Senator Higgins, it's not that we're trying to kill legislation. The board's role under the Medical Practice Act is to protect the public. The board feels that that particular bill in the form we saw it last year would have a negative effect on those patients who were receiving prescriptions for controlled substances, particularly in the area of psychiatric patients and pain management patients. And we did not see that bill in that form was in the best interest of protecting the public. The board also felt that because of the involvement of regulators that we would be affected by that, similar to a program that went on in the mid to late 90s called the PADS Project, in which higher than anticipated quantities of controlled substances were identified by the Department of Human Services and forwarded to us for investigative purposes, and took away a great deal of our resources needlessly. So that's why we voted to oppose this.
Thank you for that clarification.
And Madam Chair, with the amendment I offered, again, I think this is a clear part of the process, and I think it's working well. I think there's a good purpose for sunsets when we create some new type of board or advisory council and something that we may not want around for a long time. But this is something that until we change the way we want to deal with these occupations, it seems to me that they'll come in here and we'll just explain the same thing again. At least the sunset in the bill was 8 years out instead of 2 years. But I would urge the committee to adopt the amendment because I think it's purely routine housekeeping work that they have to come back here every few years to do. And I think sunset should be reserved for something that's questionable whether we want it to continue, not something just to make another step in the process.
Thank you.
I'm not treating it like an author's amendment. I just think it makes sense to do.
Do we have any more questions for Senator Marty on his amendment? No? I think then we can take a vote on the amendment.
That's correct. Do we take a vote on the amendment?
Okay, so all of those in favor of adopting the amendment for Senate File 26. Sorry. signify by saying aye.
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 All of those opposed? Okay.
Madam Chair, the bill has been requested, I believe, by Senator Rest's committee. So I'll move that the bill be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Do we have Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Mr. Leach, as long as you're here, I wondered if you could just give us a little update on the lawsuit that the board is involved with.
Senator Berglund, I don't believe I can do that.
Well, could I just ask if you expect it to be resolved soon?
I certainly hope so. Actually, Senator Berglund, the board is involved in has recently been involved in two lawsuits. So I don't specifically know which lawsuit you're talking about.
I was thinking of the one that was initiated and in the news last session.
On advice of our counsel, I really can't speak to that.
But you do expect that it might be resolved before the end of this year?
Oh, I would hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for Senator Marty or for our witness? If not, we're going to move. Do we need an amendment? Do we need to?
We need to act on Senator Marty's motion.
Okay. Does he have to repeat the motion or not?
You can or he can.
Senator Marty, could you repeat the motion so that we can vote?
Yeah, sure, I will, but I just remembered we forgot on Senator Pappas' bill in here. We should ask if anybody in the audience wished to speak with concerns about the bill. So,
okay. Does anybody in the audience wants to speak about this bill?
If not, okay. I'll move that Senate File 26 as amended be recommended, pass, and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
All of those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
Okay. Very much.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Senator Solon's bill may be next.
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, I have Senate File 164, and this seeks to provide the higher group residential housing rate for two different organizations that are making a commitment to serve a particularly challenging population. I think this relates to the same level of reimbursement and a waiving of the moratorium as Senator Pappas's bill was. The St. Cloud HRA and Duluth Center City Housing have joined forces with this proposal because they are providing housing options to serve chronic inebriates. The approach that these organizations are taking helps the people directly served, the communities in which the people would otherwise be living on the streets, and the state of Minnesota by saving resources that would be used for treatment at detoxification centers, emergency room visits, or criminal justice interventions. This housing with services approach provides a humane and cost-effective approach to serving a very challenging population. I am pleased that we have a representative from each of the two organizations who have been involved in developing these housing options in their communities. Mr. Chairman, I have Bruce Thielman from the St. Cloud HRA and Rick Klun from Duluth Center City Housing here to tell you about the projects that are being developed in these communities, the services that will be provided in those facilities, and the importance of this higher group residential housing rate to allow them to serve this population. And then following their presentations, we'll respond to any questions that committee members might have.
Thank you. I don't care which one goes first.
I think Mr. Thielman.
I guess I can go first. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for taking the time today to hear us. I represent the St. Cloud Housing and Redevelopment Authority. I'm the executive director there, and my name is Bruce Thielman. And St. Cloud has demonstrated a need for permanent housing for chronic inebriates. We participate in a study that's gone on over 5 years. It's a study done by the Maxfield Group, and it identifies at least 65 people in the St. Cloud area that are chronically inebriate, and they need assistance in terms of permanent housing. Because of their condition, they're unable to retain housing because of a variety of factors, I just wanted to kind of give you a general overview of what St. Cloud is looking at. We're looking at a project that is for 40 beds. It's called the Rivercrest Project, and it's going to be operated by the Brott, B-R-O-T-T, Brott family, who's very familiar with providing these services in the St. Cloud area. So they've stepped forward, and they'd like to satisfy this need. And there's four counties that converge in the St. Cloud area. There's Stearns, Benton, Sherburn, and Wright counties that converge. And so there'd be first priority would be to provide services for those four counties. And then their second priority would be to serve chronic inebriates that would come from all over the state, all the remaining 80-some counties, as long as they've got the proper paperwork to do that. But there's three things that I guess I'd like to focus on just to keep it simple today. And one of them is that 50% of what the study finds is that 50% of the chronic inebriates in the St. Cloud area are veterans. Now, St. Cloud has got one of two regional VA centers in the state, and so we've got responsibilities in the St. Cloud area that other communities may not have. The St. Cloud VA is only one of 34 VA centers that offers chemical dependency and homeless services. So, again, that creates a special burden in the St. Cloud area, and this draws veterans from all over the Midwest. The second thing I want to stress is that many group residential homes in the St. Cloud area treat persons that have mental illnesses, but because of the need, we have to also intermingle the chronic inebriates with those with mental illnesses, and that creates problems, incompatibility problems. So that's one other issue. And then the third thing I wanted to bring up is that the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has directed a substantial amount of support for this project. In the recent funding round for tax credits, we were awarded tax credits and money from the Ending Long-Term Homelessness Fund, which is an initiative of the governor and MHFA, obviously, their Housing Trust Fund for Long-Term Homelessness, and Tax Credit Authority, and additional support from the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. So there's support at the MHFA level for this project as well. And due to the high level of supported services, in order to make it operationally feasible, we need to have the supplemental rate, because they need 24-hour care. And so there's a moratorium on that, and so that's what we're here today for. And we have a similar project in Duluth that you may or may not be familiar with, and I'll let Rick finish that.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today regarding the legislation you're considering regarding an enhanced rate for group residential housing. My name is Rick Klun, and I am the executive director for a not-for-profit organization in Duluth called Center City Housing Corp. Center City Housing Corp. is a housing developer, owner, and program manager of housing for very low, meaning no income, to moderate income individuals and families. We have been in business for about 20 years. I'm here today to ask for your legislative support for an enhanced GRH rate, not unlike St. Cloud or Ramsey County, for our new San Marcos supportive apartment project. And you have a handout that we just passed out. When we open in mid-April of this year, the new San Marco will provide housing with supports to some of Duluth's most needy people. The 70-unit building will serve two distinct populations, and the building is built in two distinct wings. The first are 40 units for people that are long-term homeless folks, and the second are 30 units for chronic inebriates. The group residential housing money that we're talking about today would be for those chronic inebriates. The housing we will provide is not only humane and will offer our residents supports that will increase the probability of succeeding in retaining housing. Supportive housing also makes fiscal sense. It is a cost-effective way of reducing the reliance and stress on law enforcement, emergency room services, and detox centers. Our request for an enhanced rate will allow Center City Housing to provide more than just room and board to our tenants. It will support 24-hour safety and security, case management services, and amenities like laundry machines and transportation to medical appointments. Without these additional dollars, the new San Marco will open, but our operation will lack what we see as essential components. Thank you for your consideration in this regard, and I would welcome your questions.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, whichever of the gentlemen want to answer is fine. In connection with the governor's initiative to end long-term homelessness, We also did appropriate money for supported services. And are you getting any of that money, or was there not enough to?
I think maybe we both want to address that individually. We're getting some of that money from the Department of Human Services for the efficiency units for the long-term homeless folks, not for the chronic inebriates in our building. So we've got, again, we've got our building is two distinct parts of the building, and part of that's going to support the long-term homeless folks that we have in the part of the building that is not the chronic inebriates.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't exactly understand what the difference is. Are the long-term homeless people not inebriates?
The long-term homeless folks in our building will not necessarily be long-term, will not necessarily be chronic inebriates. They will be people that are long-term homeless for a whole variety of reasons, including mental health issues, poor job histories, moving to town without doing proper planning, and a whole variety of issues.
And so, Mr. Chairman, the chronic inebriates are not homeless?
Most of the people are homeless, and some may be chronically homeless, but some may be living in very, very substandard housing now and without the supports that we can provide.
Okay. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Solon, or either of your guests, did I hear you say that this is not to deal with mental illness? It's strictly for the chronic inebriate, this portion that we're talking about today.
The funding that we're requesting is to deal with chronic inebriates.
Mr. Chair, so what requirements will there be of these folks to live in, excuse me, in permanent housing that we're subsidizing if their problem is just plain that they're excessive drinkers but not necessarily mentally ill? Are we going to require that they not drink, or are we just going to provide a place for them to drink?
Mr. Thiel.
Thank you, Chair Marty and Senator Berglund. That the case is that on a chronic inebriate there, and I'm not an expert at this, you could probably get somebody to testify better at that, but my understanding is that they're not curable, or they're not able to be treated to cure the disease. It's a disease that they're gonna remain alcoholics, and that causes a problem for society. It causes a problem for the community, and so that creates a burden in the emergency wards, in the detox centers, and for the police, and they're unable to retain housing. So it's a general problem, specific problem really in the community.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, this is a population that's been through detox 20, 30 times in the past. They've been through treatment probably 8, 10, 12 times in the past. They are people that are chronically ill, suffering the effects of that long-term alcoholism, and they are not able to move through a treatment facility adequately. This is a place that would provide them food and shelter. I believe they cannot drink in the facility. They can drink, but they can drink. They have to leave the facility to drink, come back, and they can reside in the facility. There is shelter for them. They will provide medical supervision, so it does not cost. It is not the high cost of the detoxification facility or the hospital emergency rooms. It is a low cost means of protecting these people.
Well, Mr. Chair, that concerns me a little bit, because essentially what we're saying is that if I choose to change my lifestyle and begin to drink and become a chronic drinker and don't change that behavior, now the government will just provide me housing and medical care and everything else, and just accept my behavior as something I'm not going to change.
Senator Wergen, as a psychologist, I beg to differ. You may not be able to be an alcoholic. You may not have the genes that allow you to be an alcoholic. It is a disease, and there are specific criteria that identify those who are chronic alcoholics. And they are mentally ill, just like people with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and they deserve to have respect and to be treated with shelter and clothing and food and medical help.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins first.
Senator Solon, is this considered sober housing?
Mr. Chair, no. I believe it's actually called a wet domiciliary is the old name.
Okay.
That they used to be called. There certainly is precedent for it. There are other facilities around.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe one of the witnesses or Senator Solon. I guess I'm curious about this. In my family, we do have a person that does have a long-term problem with alcohol use and hasn't yet been able to overcome that. We're still hopeful that that may happen, but we don't know. But one of the things that was actually explored by people in his immediate family was to look at commitment. In other words, committing somebody into an institutionalized setting, in effect, to prevent them from doing further damage to their health and so forth. And my question, it turns out that didn't seem to be a very realistic option for a variety of reasons. And my question would be, if you do have people that, as you say, are unable to stop drinking, would it not be better to then say, instead of just providing them with a residence and shelter, to allow them to continue to try to put them into a facility where they, in effect, would not be able to, and treat it as an ongoing mental health or other disability that, if it's not treatable, then would they not be better off to at least be someplace where they're isolated and not able to do harm to themselves or others by driving or whatever else they may do? I'm curious about the approach here and why this is a better approach than trying to do something like a commitment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, sorry, maybe the gentleman can answer this better than I can. There are not facilities any longer where you can commit people. We've been slowly closing down all those institutions where people used to be committed. And these are people who probably have effects to their neural system and their neurological system, their brain, in which they're not able to control their use any longer. But this does provide them with safety and protection, and it's a low-cost alternative to incarceration in any type of an institution.
Senator Torres, Ray.
I have a question with respect. I have attended a meeting in the community in Minneapolis, and they talk about the importance of having these type of programs for these groups, because I think some of the arguments in Minneapolis were related to the cost of having to address the issues. And I don't know if you have any information that you can provide, because apparently we have a growing number of people who are facing this, and it was proposed actually at this meeting that we should consider this kind of effort as well, because we have a growing number of homeless people who have this illness, and that this effort will actually save money, because the police department is having to go and that they have to place them in some place. So we actually end up providing the same service, but through a system that is not very cost-effective. So could you talk about that, please?
I'll try addressing that a little bit. Senator Hahn, if I'm saying it correctly, maybe I could just address your question a little bit. And I, like Bruce, are not an expert in alcoholism treatment. But what I can tell you is alcoholism is a very, very complex issue, and for every person it's very different. And there are some people that truly need institutionalization. But with institutionalization, people also lose a lot of freedoms. And I worked in an institution back in the early 70s, and our goal was to get everybody out. And we went from a population of 235 to 67 in a matter of 18 months because there are many people that didn't need to live there. Really, it limits your freedoms. I think the type of building and program we're talking about is less restrictive than that and is healthy for a subset, a small group of very hardcore chronic alcoholics. One of the things we talk about when we talk about Our program is the three-thirds. One-third of the people will get somewhat better, one-third of the people will stay the same, and one-third will die. These are people with chronic liver disease. These are people with diabetes where their feet need to be amputated. We're not talking about the guy that stopped for a few beers on Friday night and got a DWI. With regard to the cost issue, there is a program in Minneapolis called Anishinaabe-Wakaagan, and I see some heads nodding up and down. That program's been in operation, I think, now for about 13 years. They found out the first year that they were in operation that the number of people entering detox went down by 900%. And the cost of detox is right now is about $220 a day, at least in Duluth. So there should be a huge fiscal saving. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bergen.
Just kind of back to my original question a little bit. Did the State Housing Finance Agency finance the entire construction of your facility, or was some of it financed with private money?
If you look at the handout that we sent around on the right side, there's a list of the funding. We got about $7 million from MHFA in three different pots of money. We also got money from the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. We got money from Minnesota Power. We got, I think there are about a dozen different sources of funds listed there.
And is that true for both of these projects?
For our project, MHFA is authorizing us for tax credit financing, so they're not actually financing it or funding it. It's through the tax credit system. And that's about $2.5 million of the $4 million that we need. So we'll end up taking a mortgage out on a portion of that. And there is a fund for about $800,000 of the ending long-term homelessness fund that's coming from MHFA. And then the rest is Greater Minnesota Housing Fund money. So we're cobbling together what we can, but we'll end up, in terms of building the actual facility, we'll have to get some outside sources. And what we need to make this operationally feasible is to get the supplemental rate. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Bergen.
What if you don't get it?
Then the project won't happen. Because there's 24-hour care needed, and the project won't cash flow without the extra rate. So.
And then will your financing from the State Housing Finance Agency go back to the agency?
I would assume so. You know, again, it's tax credit authorization, so we just wouldn't use the tax credits on it.
And is that true for the facility in Duluth also?
Our facility will open in mid-April. We've put together all of the construction funds. We raised those construction funds in 18 months. What we're talking to you folks again about today is operations funds. And we will open and we will use the GRH rate that we have in place now when we open, but it will make it very difficult to do things like 24-hour round-the-clock coverage on the floors. It'll make it difficult to have those case managers that will help with medically related issues for these folks. Medical transportation, those kinds of things.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Solon, I'm not asking these questions to try to make it seem like this project isn't worthwhile. My concern is if there's funding coming from the State Housing Finance Agency that then is putting pressure on additional requests for general fund spending that isn't already accounted for in the governor's budget. That's a little bit of a concern to me, and I'm not sure, you know, if these are the only ones or, you know, if there's more in the pipeline out there coming. That's the reason for my questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could address a couple other questions. We weren't prepared to do a lot of number crunching here today, but we do have this study, this Maxfield study, that's from July of 2006. And of the – just looking at the additional – you know, we're going to have additional money that's going to – we're asking for the supplemental rate. But the offset to that is that there's this burden that you have in the emergency rooms and the detox centers and the police departments and those sort of things. And the Maxfield report says that they track 25 of the chronic inebriates in the St. Cloud area, and the annual cost just to the detox centers was $15,000 a year for each one of those persons. What we're asking for the supplemental rate is actually about $700 per month times 12, which would be $8,400. So you can see that that's about 50% of what's already being spent. And that doesn't include emergency, it doesn't include police, it doesn't include temporary housing, those sort of things that are already a cost to the city, the county, or the state. So financially, we feel as though this is actually a savings to the state and is providing a service to the community and to society, obviously. Thank you.
Senator Dahl, then Senator Wergen, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I see that you've got 30 beds in the one facility and 40 in the other, and I'm assuming that we've got some fairly lengthy stays with the folks that would be there, and also that the one in Stearns County is a large percentage of them are veterans. Are we meeting the needs in those areas, or is there a waiting list that you're not able to meet, and if so, like, how long of a list is that?
In St. Louis County, we've identified in excess of 100 people that need the services that we're providing. Senator Berglund asked about the other sources of funding. The funding that we're getting from DHS to help with these supportive services, we've identified that 40% of the folks that we will serve will be Native American. There's a huge need there. We've got an inordinate number of chronic alcoholics and people in poverty that are people of color.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I can just quote some numbers. The VA in St. Cloud in the year 2004-2005 had 596 veterans admitted to the St. Cloud VA for treatment, and 45% of those veterans were homeless, just to try to give you an idea. And we've identified, this study identifies 65 people, and there's probably more than that because we draw from the Midwest at this regional treatment center at the VA.
Mr. Thielman, you mentioned the 65 earlier, and Mr. Kuhn mentioned 100 people. When you do this, the 40-bed selection is based on what you can feasibly cover? In other words, if there's 65, you're going to have roughly two-thirds of them would be taken care of. The rest will continue to use the detox system. How did you come up with the number of 40?
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. We don't want to oversupply. You know, you don't want to build a building so big that you can't fill it and you can't operate it. And I guess I'd have to refer to Rick's formula where you have the one-third, one-third, one-third. And so one of those thirds are not going to be there. So it just makes operational sense to not create an oversupply of units.
I'd concur.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thielman, can you tell me, for a chronic inebriate that's going to stay in this facility, what will they have individual, like, apartments? What will the unit look like? What will be provided for them? Kind of run through me what we're going to provide and, you know, square footage per person, all that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burton, it's a very Spartan unit. You know, I should have the operator here. The Brats should be here, but they're provided a room. It's more like a studio apartment. I don't know the square footage. I believe it's less than 500 square feet. The HRA recently did a project on the VA grounds in St. Cloud that was funded with MHFA with some bonding money, and that's a 500 square foot studio apartment. These will be smaller. And there'll be communal meals, communal baths, those sort of things. So it's not an extravagant at all.
Senator Wergen, Mr. Chairman, our efficiency, our SRO units, single resident occupancy units for the chronic inebriates are 275 square feet. They have a bathroom. We will have a bed, a closet, a chair, a dresser, and a small table in those rooms. The folks will be served 3 hot meals a day, 7 days a week. Our building will have, again, 24-hour front desk security service, and also have 24-hour-a-day service, technician service on that unit for those folks. We're going to give people tokens for their laundry, because we think they'll do better if they have clean laundry, and they probably will live healthier if they have clean laundry. The DHS money that Senator Berglund we talked about a little bit earlier, we're looking at having 10 hours a week of nursing services, and that would be paid with that DHS supportive housing money. Next to the folks that we're dealing with, next to their alcoholism, the next biggest challenge in their life is the medical conditions that they're in.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a couple of questions. One is that, and one of you mentioned in your testimony that this is being put in place because of the kinds of problems that chronic inebriates have in managing their lives sufficiently to live in other ways. And my question is, does that change? I mean, what is it that will compel them to stay and participate and see the reductions in cost to detox and other facilities? My limited experience is that people that are chronically inebriate are very erratic in their behavior and their judgment. It's very hard to, for them, I think, to take long-term views of things and be consistent in their behaviors. And so part of it is, does this really help solve that problem? If they're not capable of making these kinds of decisions anyway, does giving them this facility really change that ability to make decisions that would allow them to live there successfully and take advantage of the things that you're offering? And I guess the second question is just, how does this fit with the approach that professionals have in treating alcoholism? Is this a positive or neutral? I mean, I've heard some things that say that with chronic inebriation, one thing you want to do is avoid enabling that behavior to continue. And does this fall into that category, or is this somehow outside of that category? And how does it fit with, I guess, the professional approach to dealing with alcoholism?
I'd be glad to take a stab at it, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn. This population is very, very far advanced in alcoholism. It isn't the typical ones you find in your families who are struggling and who've been through treatment several times, or your neighbors. These are people who are living in chronic alcoholism. They're homeless, they're jobless, they have no family and friends left. And providing them a safe place actually helps them to stay out and away from where a lot of the drinking is occurring. Most of them don't have any place but to hang around where the drinking is occurring. And so this at least provides them an option. And if you'd ask them, most of them say they don't want to drink. They don't want to drink, but they don't know how not to drink at this point. They have just totally lost control. So having a safe place actually does provide them some refuge and some place for not having to drink.
Further questions? If not, Senator Solon moves at Senate File 164.
Be recommended to pass, and I believe it must be re-referred to the Finance Division.
I believe that would be the right motion. Is there any further discussion on the bill? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Senator Berglund. Senate File 154.
Chairman and members of the committee, most of the provisions that are in Senate File 154 are provisions that have been before the legislature in the past, and we've made some small progress in some of these areas, but there is much more that remains to be done. The bill has a number of provisions which essentially are attempting to buy back cuts that were made in 2003, both to our child care programs and to people in our MFIP program. Sections 1 and 2 would make our child care assistance co-payments the same as they were in 2003. And then Section 5 repeals medical assistance co-payments, the MFIP family cap, the $50 housing penalty, and the $125 SSI penalties to recipients in the MFIP program. The other two portions of the bill, one of them was in last year's bill. It requests a 10% increase in the MFIP transitional standard effective January 1st, 2008. It's been decades and decades since there was a cost of living increase given in this program, and the standard is a very low standard for people to live on in this program. And we need to remember that not everyone in this program is going to be working their way off into self-sufficiency. Some people in this program are disabled, and they have to live on this amount of money for the rest of their lives, or at least the rest of their lives when they have children. So it is a hardship not to have ever have an increase in the standard. And then Section 4 of the bill modifies the definition of work activity to prohibit unpaid work performed in return for cash assistance unless the participant voluntarily agrees to that in writing. And I am working on another bill that would make it so we don't need to rely on workfare in order to meet the new federal work participation rates. And so this goes kind of hand in hand with that. Most of the time, these workfare type of jobs don't lead to real paid employment, and so it really means that a participant is using their time up while they're in that type of program without really making progress towards self-sufficiency. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, that I need to offer to the bill. It's the A2 amendment. I would move adoption of the amendment, and then I'll explain that page 1, lines 2 through 5 are technical corrections, and page 1, lines 6 through 24 make the parental copayment $5 for child care for families between 75 and 100% of the federal poverty guidelines. And that is consistent with what the child care copayment was in 2003.
Senator Berglund moves the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment. We'll wait till it's at least distributed, however. Is there any discussion on the A2 amendment? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to have the people that there's quite a list of people to testify or take questions, whichever you prefer at
this
time.
Questions from the committee first. We have a lot of names on the list of testifiers, so if there aren't any, we can just begin. Should we call on the list, Senator Berglund?
That would be fine, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
First, Ms. Koenig and Trishala Bell. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Marty, and I'd like to thank all the legislators for coming out today to take time to listen to my testimony. My name is Trishala. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. Some of you are familiar with me. Some of the people who are new may not. So I'm just going to read my testimony, and I do have copies of it. Because we're here to speak in favor of Senate File 154. This bill will start to address some of the worst cuts affecting children of Minnesota in the areas of welfare, health care, and child care. With the 5-year lifetime limit on welfare and so many devastating cuts to poor people's programs in the past 4 years, Senate File 154 is really just the tip of the iceberg of what really needs to be done to start helping poor and working families living in poverty. In 2003, with a deficit over $4 billion, the governor and legislators cut over $2 billion from Health and Human Services, balancing the budget on the backs of the poor and working Minnesotans, the elderly, and the disabled. The cuts to Minnesota Families Cash Assistance Program, MFIP, were the largest cuts to welfare in the history of Minnesota. The first is the $125 cut to families with disability. This cut takes $125 per month from the MFIP grant if a household member is severely disabled and on SSI. A mother and a child's MFIP grant is only $437. For them, this is a 28% grant cut. This cut targets disabled families for the biggest cut ever imposed on welfare. Poor families on MFIP should not be financially penalized on top of having to cope with disability in the family. This cut uses a person's disability as an instrument to hurt their loved ones. This cut is cruel, should have never have happened, and must be undone. The other welfare cut is the $50 housing cut to families in subsidized housing. Families who receive MFIB and live in subsidized housing, Section 8, or public housing are having their monthly cash grant cut by $50. When you're living 60% below the poverty line, $50 is a very serious amount. Senate File 154 also undoes other cruel cuts from 2003, including the MA copays, child care copays, and the family cap. Senate File 154 also provides a cost of living increase for the terribly inadequate Children and Family Welfare Grant. The monthly grant in Minnesota has not seen an increase since 1986. This means the poorest children and families in Minnesota have gone 21 years without a cost of living increase. The actual cost of living, however, has increased by 84% in the past 21 years. In 1986, the monthly grant for a family of two is $437, and in 2007, the monthly grant for a family is still $437. It wasn't enough back then, and it's certainly not enough now. We have testified year after year about how inadequate the welfare grants are. These are the cold facts. One mother with one child receives $437 a month to survive. This adds up to $5,244 a year. A family of four receives $621 a month, totaling $7,452 for an entire year. The federal government puts the federal poverty threshold for a family of four at $19,806. That puts Minnesota children who are living on welfare 62% below the federal poverty guideline. And that's also just the beginning of the story. Since 2003, poor children and their caregivers have faced the greatest attacks on welfare income in the history of Minnesota. Governor Pawlenty led the charge to balance the budget by cutting further from these abysmal income amounts, cutting an additional 11% to over 50% from the monthly grant in order to balance the budget, and this is a crime. Did housing costs freeze 20 years ago? No. Did the cost of food freeze 20 years ago? No. Did health care and child care costs freeze over the past 20 years? No. In contrast to the income of the poorest Minnesotans, the governor's salary has increased by 70% in the past 20 years. We are calling on all senators to pass the cost of living increase to the welfare grant this year. 21 years is 21 years too long for poor Minnesota families. And that's my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Bell. Is there any questions from the committee? Not Ms. Kaneki.
Thank you, Senator Marty, and thank you for the chance to testify. My name is Deb Knitschny. I am also a member of the Welfare Rights Committee, and I'm going to testify on workfare. The Welfare Rights Committee is completely opposed to workfare. Workfare forces caregivers receiving welfare to work for no pay in order to receive the monthly welfare grant. It is an attack on poor parents on welfare, and it is also an attack on all working people. Senator Berglund's bill, SF-154, prohibits workfare in Minnesota. These are some of the reasons that workfare is wrong. First of all and foremost, if there is a job that needs to be done, it needs to be made into a real job with real and livable wages. Then we won't have to be on welfare in the first place. Workfare drives down wages for all working people. If bosses know they can go down to the welfare office to get impoverished mothers or fathers to work for free, it undermines any incentive to pay a living wage, or in this case, any wage at all. Workfare displaces paying jobs. And often these jobs are decent paying or union jobs. And we saw that example in New York City after the 96 federal welfare changes, Workfare was allowed to be used to meet the job requirements. Over 30,000 plus union jobs in Parks Department and transportation were lost as welfare recipients were forced to work for free in order to get the grant. So-called volunteer work is never volunteer if there is a threat of sanction over the families. No job counselor or county financial worker should be in a position to force people into slave labor. Workfare ignores that the principal reason families are on assistance is because this economy is not providing the jobs needed to raise our families. There's a serious lack of affordable housing, childcare, education, and health care. Workfare does not solve these underlying issues. Workfare has also been around for a long time all over the country, and the Welfare Rights Committee fought against this over 10 years ago, and we were successful in getting it nearly eliminated in Minnesota. But Workfare is back, and the Department of Human Services and Governor Pawlenty are pushing it to the forefront this year. That's why it needs to be dealt with this year. There is not a kinder or more meaningful form of workfare, whether it's a retail job, picking up garbage on the street, or a job at a charity or nonprofit that provides service to the community. Workfare is still workfare. It is still forced free labor. The only truly meaningful work is work that pays us a wage, a livable wage, and benefits so that we can finally get our families out of poverty. If the door is open to workfare, it will become a first choice option for welfare workers under the gun of the DHS to meet work requirements. Everyone knows it's easier to find a job where someone has to go to work for free than it is to do the hard work to find a real job with real wages. Workfare jobs do not have to and will not turn into real jobs. When they are done with us, they can go down to the welfare office and get another welfare recipient who is being forced to work for free. Or they just hire someone else who is not free into the position when they let us go. While poor parents on welfare are being forced to work for free, they're also under the five-year lifetime limit that continues to tick away while giving their free labor away. So we can conceivably work for free for most of our 5 years and then be thrown off welfare with no options for any income because we never were able to get a real job. And just a couple of points about policy. In October of 2006, the Minnesota Department of Human Services opened the door for more people to be pushed into slave labor workfare programs, and Pawlenty's current budget proposal would expand that workfare statewide. In an outrageous move, Pawlenty's new budget proposal takes $1.65 million a year from TANF. This is money that is supposed to be used for poor families, and it gives that as grants to counties to set up these slave labor programs for families in the public and private sector. Minnesota does not need to do workfare to meet federal welfare regulations. There are many other options under federal law that will meet the work requirements, such as subsidized work for pay, such as on-the-job training for pay, and education. And these are the options that Minnesota should take. And furthermore, we say that Minnesota should stand up on principle against federal legislated attacks on poor and working people. The effects of workfare on the state of Minnesota would be devastating. And in the past, when states have stood up to outrageous federal laws, the federal government has been forced to change these laws. Minnesota actually makes one of the federal options, education, harder to use because in Minnesota, we're forced to work 20 hours on top of the education in order to qualify. This makes education an impossibility for most of us. And in Senator Berglund's bill, that 20-hour work requirement is lifted so that more of us could get education. New federal regulations allow only 4 to 6 weeks of job search in a year, and everyone here must know that it takes more than 4 weeks to find a job. Again, according to this, we could actually be allowed to look for a job for 4 weeks. If we don't find it, go to work for free for 11 months, next year get 4 weeks to look for a job again, then go to work for free for 11 months, and on until we run out of our time limit. Finally, Governor Pawlenty has said that the federal penalty for not meeting work requirements is the reason to force poor parents to work for free in workfare programs. By all estimates, there are only 2 states in the nation who have a chance to meet the federal requirements. Ironically, the federal penalty would add up to $13.5 million, the exact same amount as the federal reward that Pawlenty has stolen from TANF for other purposes 3 years in a row. So if Governor Pawlenty is worried about the penalty, we say he can just give that money back and we'll break even without allowing slave labor in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thank you. Questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. Oh, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I need to know just a little bit more how the workfare works. I mean, is it they ask you to take on a job? I mean, what types of jobs are they? I mean, and what types of employers actually use this service? Can you give me just a brief summary of that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, the description I will give you is not exclusive, but it's the most common practice. A county will create a position within their own organization, and then they will require someone who's on the MFIP program to show up and do that job, but they are not paid minimum wage or given any benefits or anything. They are required to show up for that job in order to receive their welfare grant.
Okay.
Now, that's the most common thing because it's the easiest for them just to create a position within their own organization. Going out to get someone in the private sector to create this kind of a position has not been done very much in the past, but it could be done in the future.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Then in going to these jobs, which are created by the county, they're responsible for transportation to and from and getting child care and things like that to
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, they're responsible to get to the job just like they would to any job that they would have in the private sector. Child care is provided under federal law. It's required to be provided, but it is not always provided in the most satisfactory way for a person that's receiving this type of program. Sometimes sometimes there are not a range of child care providers available, so that there is not much choice in regard to the child care that's provided.
Senator Dahl, in our experience, because we're out talking, you know, we're on the street talking to everyone, and we actually dealt with this over 10 years ago. In Minnesota, so far it's been mostly nonprofits. And some may be just make work programs, and some may be doing work, but it's always for no pay. But the experience of other states, and there will be people to testify on that, is there are private jobs being used for it. There are union jobs that are being displaced by it. And in Governor Pawlenty's proposal, he opens it up to private and public jobs. And so in our view, and the reality is it doesn't matter what kind of job it is. The fact is it is for free. There is no pay. So if it's a nonprofit or a private or a public sector, whatever it is, it has an impact on all workers that are looking for jobs or have jobs. There's nothing to say that if I have a little job, they wouldn't fire me to go down and get someone to work for free. They can do that. You can fire at will in this state. So the impact can be devastating on a state, and luckily this state is so far to this point has chosen to not use workfare, you know, except as the last resort. We want to say it cannot be used. If that's a real job, make it a job and pay us so we can get off welfare and have an income.
Thank you.
further questions? If not, we have plenty more witnesses, Ms. Hosmer and Ms. Laugen. Thank you both. Go ahead, either one of you, please identify yourself.
I'm Virginia Weldon, and I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee.
Go ahead, then. Okay. Make your presentation.
I also have some copies if you want to pass these out. This is my testimony that I... it's a testimony stating that what I've been through on the infant program and also your... work fair program. So here's my testimony. Hello, my name is Virginia Weldon. I am a recent recipient of InfIMP and a mother of two. I am here to testify about my experience with welfare and looking for work and about my recent experience of being forced to work for free under InfIMP. I had been working at a job for over 3 years, but because of surgery and medical conditions that still I am suffering from, I was forced to leave my job and go on welfare in order to support my family. While on InfIMP, I was a victim of domestic violence. My son and I were homeless. I was suffering from spinal damage and severe pain, and all the time I was doing extensive job search to meet job requirements. I participated in different training programs to upgrade my skills and engaged in job search of 20 to 40 hours per week. But after months and months of repeated job search, I was given only one interview, was never accepted for a job, and received dozens of rejection letters. I also applied for disability for my medical condition several times and was rejected. While I was dealing with severe medical problems, domestic violence, homelessness, joblessness, and living in poverty, my son and I were trying to survive on a cash grant from InfIMP of $437 a month. The welfare is only a survival check. It is not something to be able to do anything beyond surviving, like doing anything enjoyable with my son. And it really was not enough to even survive. Then in 2003, because of welfare cuts passed by Minnesota politicians, my son and I had $50 a month cut in the infant grant because we have subsidized housing. So then we were trying to survive on $387 a month. Tell me how anyone in Minnesota thinks a family can survive on this little money. I couldn't afford a household phone to use the phone. I had to bus to Walgreens to get a prepaid card, and then every time I needed to use the phone, I had to walk 3 blocks to the nearest payphone. When you are already living in poverty, you are already living in crisis. If you have an emergency, you can't call 911. You can't look for a job easily because you have no phone. Finally, I want to testify about my experience of being forced to do what is called workfare, but is simply forced work for no pay. In March of 2005, I was forced to work for free for over 5 months in order to receive my infant grant of $387 a month. My job counselor threatened me with sanctions to my welfare grant and told me that I had to do volunteer work because I couldn't find paid employment, like it was my fault that no one would hire me. My primary doctor stated 3 times with 3 different forms that I was not able to work because of multiple internal injuries, but I was still forced to work for no pay. I was forced to work 33.75 hours per week at a nonprofit, which equaled up to 135 hours a month. I was getting a welfare grant of $387 a month. If you divide $387 by 135 hours, this means I was only making $2.86 an hour per hour if I was actually getting paid. But in fact, I was being forced to work for free just to get a tiny welfare grant. I was working as an administrative support person, which I should have been paid no less than $10 an hour. To add insult to my injuries, after months of working for free, When I hit my welfare limit, the nonprofit let me go and hired a different person to do the exact same job I was, but for pay. This is the degrading, discriminatory situation I was forced to do just so I could get my infant grant. This is slave labor for any poor and working families on welfare. This is a clear example of how this brutal welfare and workfare reform is not about ending poverty. It is about pushing poor women into free labor or low-wage labor and trapping us into poverty for life. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weldon. Questions from the committee? If not, Ms. Hosmer?
Hi. My name is Kim Hosmer. I'm also a member of the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm here to tell you why we should raise the welfare grants this year. Before I start, I'd like you to think back to 1986. Think about where you were working, how much you were making, how much did you pay for rent, how much did you spend at the grocery store. Now imagine if you had to live on your 1986 salary today. No way? Ridiculous? You've got to be kidding, you'd probably say. But that's exactly what Minnesota's poor families are being forced to do every day. I went on AFDC in 1984. I'd been attending the U of M and had just been laid off from my campus job when I found out I was pregnant with my daughter. I left school at the end of the quarter and went to stay at Lutheran Social Services, where I shared a one-bedroom apartment with two other single moms-to-be. And those of you who have ever been pregnant know that three pregnant women in a one-bedroom and, more importantly, a one-bathroom apartment is no fun. I worked part-time throughout my pregnancy and then applied for AFDC after my daughter was born. I stayed in a homeless shelter for 2 months with my infant daughter while looking for affordable housing. With a grant of only $434 a month, there were not many options. I found an apartment, finally, in a high-rise that offered Section 8. For those of you who might not know about Section 8, it provides rent based on your income, so it's based on about a third of your income. Even with this subsidy, I struggled to make ends meet. Out of my meager grant of $434 a month, I had to pay my rent, my phone bill, buy diapers, pay for laundry, buy all my soap, toilet paper, etc., and any food that we needed beyond the roughly $179, or just under $1 per person per meal in food stamps. I was always broke, always running out of food before the end of the month, and I visited the food shelf every month. I had several part-time jobs through the years, but I also had student loans quickly going into default because I couldn't make payments. In 1986, the grant was raised a whopping 1%, from $434 to $437 a month. We celebrated by buying an extra gallon of milk for that month. That was the first and last raise we ever got. Worse yet, the cash grant for people on MFIP today is still $437 a month for a mother and child. In other words, the buying power of that welfare grant has decreased by 84%. Could you stand to live with a decrease of 84% of your wages? I don't think so. My daughter and I struggled on for 10 more years. While it was hard, I knew that compared to so many others in our same circumstances, we were the lucky ones. We had the benefit of Section 8, which was truly the primary thing that gave us what little stability we had. I cannot tell you how many times we faced daily choices about paying necessary bills or buying enough groceries, let alone clothes, shoes, school pictures. Those of you with children know what a challenge it is to raise healthy, well-adjusted children, even under the best of circumstances. Imagine doing it on $437 a month. Then came welfare reform in 1996. Time limits, sanctions, and deeper poverty. You've heard about those, some of those already today. When we didn't think it could get any worse, the 2003 budget brought even more cuts, the $50 housing cut, the $125 per person on SSI in your family. Thankfully, we got some of that adjusted in years after, but it's still there per family. The reality of welfare is that most parents on welfare have worked and do work, as I did, But without the opportunity to get education and with the lack of livable wage jobs, it is extremely difficult to find a path out of poverty. Despite this, most families are only on assistance for 2 years or less. Those like myself who stay longer almost always have additional barriers. In fact, according to a Ramsey County worker who testified in the House hearing last week, nearly 90% of the parents in their caseload that had been sanctioned for not making their work requirements later turned out to be eligible for disability. But of course, there was no screening in the beginning. And my understanding is that the federal regulations give you only 6 weeks to screen, was what I heard in that testimony. The fact is, if we have any other option than to live at over 60% below the federal poverty level on welfare, we take that option. Families on welfare are on welfare because they have run out of other options. It is much harder to climb out of poverty and leave welfare when the grants keep you and your children in extreme poverty, 60% below the federal poverty level. And for those of you who know about the history of that poverty level, that was based on a family of four with a bare minimum food budget, and they gave them 80% of that. So it's not even close to what it needs to be. It's based on food being your biggest expense, and now housing is usually that. So this is the year to raise the grants. 20 years is too long. Poor Minnesota families have suffered long enough.
Thank you very much. The questions from the committee. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, just for my education, if you were to get a job, does the welfare automatically stop, or is there a sliding scale that you're able to supplement, or how does
that
work?
There's a little bit of a bump to what the grant is. You get to earn a certain percentage over, but my understanding is that when you get to about, I think it was either $6.50 or $7 an hour at full-time wages, you completely lose the cash grant.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bergen.
Senator Dahl, the exit level is 115% of poverty.
Okay. Further questions? If not, thank you very much, both of you. Ms. Fernie next, and also then Deborah Schlick. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Fernie, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Start? All right. Thank you. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee also. I've been a core member for 5 years. My name is Tracy Fernie, and I'm here to testify in support of Senator Berglund's bill SF-154. And to testify about the 125 SSI penalty. I am a current recipient of welfare in Minnesota. My husband and I are both disabled and unable to work. Myself and other families receiving welfare are seeing and feeling the devastation and consequences of living so deep in poverty. This is my daughter, Sunny, and she's the one that is being affected by the $125 cut. Homelessness is skyrocketing. Mothers are not able to provide a home or a safe haven for their children, their families, and themselves to live. Our children are going to school hungry. They're coming home, and there's still no food in the refrigerator. Life is a constant daily struggle just to make ends meet. Our families are so stressed out, and our children are being severely affected by their parents because the parents are so stressed out that it's affecting our children, and this is not fair. This is abuse, neglect of our government, and it needs to stop. Life is a constant daily struggle just to make ends meet. Our families are fighting for our lives. This is very serious business here. Everybody counts. We all count here. This is the reality before 2003 cuts. In 2003, Governor Plenty and the Minnesota legislators passed the deepest and most devastating cuts to welfare in the history of Minnesota. They cut $125 every month from the welfare grant of a family if any member of the family is disabled and receiving SSI. This means that right now the welfare grant for my daughter, Sunny, is cut from $250 a month to $125. This is a $50 cut. This adds up to $1,500 a year. Well, $1,500 a year may not seem like a lot to you, but to our families who are living in poverty, it means everything. You know, it means my daughter might be able to actually go to the zoo a couple times a year, or see some movies, or get some new clothes, or some new toys, or something. You know, she should be able to enjoy life too. The money that disabled members receive is supposed to be met to meet the needs for the people that are on disability. Our children should not be penalized because we have disabilities. Oftentimes, our disabilities make it more difficult for us to handle stressors. Like, for instance, myself, I have been hospitalized 5 times. I have post-traumatic stress disorder. I have short and long-term memory loss. I'm bipolar. I have asthma. I have a bad back. And if I have another nervous breakdown, I'll end up in the hospital if I go into psychosis. Not everybody has the same mental faculties. We don't all, you know, not all of us are blessed. Not all of us have been educated. Not all of us have been brought up in the same type of family environments. And some people, you know, like some people who are sent to war can come home fine. Other people are, they've completely lost it, you know. I'm the kind of person, I can't handle so much stress, you know. Enough is enough. So, you know, oftentimes our disabilities make it more difficult for us to handle stressors, and dealing with these added burdens of financial stress is enough to send us right to the hospital. We already didn't have enough to make ends meet, and now we really don't have enough money to cover our rent, car insurance, gas, electric bills, phone bills, laundry, money for clothes, money for food, and all the basic things that are just needed to just survive. It's really a struggle, and yes, I am resourceful. I'm not going to let my kid go hungry. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of people out there that they don't have resources. They don't know, you know. It's a big mess. It's just one big mess, and we've all got to get together, and we need to figure out how to. We can all come together and do something about this devastating mess that we're all in. I wouldn't be coming here year after year, you know, if I knew that it really wasn't really, really important. And we're literally fighting for our lives here. And it's imperative to undo this devastating SSI cut and to really understand the severity of what is going on here. These matters are of such great importance, and they should not be ignored. So I call on all people in your positions of power, because you can make a difference for our poor families this year. I know you guys can. This SSI penalty should have never been passed in the first place, and it should not be allowed to continue one more year. So I call on you to do the right thing, to please stop this cut and to stop all welfare cuts now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Ms. Schlick.
Senator Marty and Senators, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We are a coalition of more than 50 organizations throughout the state of Minnesota who advocate for an effective welfare-to-work program and for opportunities that allow families to truly move out of poverty. We're here today to commend this bill. We think this is a year that it is very important that the legislature take seriously welfare-to-work policy and policy for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Changes passed by Congress in their last session have made it very difficult for this state to meet its performance target. The risk of not meeting that target is the risk of losing significant funds in the TANF block grant that comes to this state. But we also think it's an important opportunity to return Minnesota's welfare-to-work program to the possibilities and potential that were proved in its demonstration pilot program in the early 90s, that when we do welfare policy right, we can see successes not only for the families but for the state. Others will talk in detail about that, but I want to remind you that most of the conversation during the session about MFIP will be about the parents, the adults on the program, but most of the people who turn to the Minnesota Family Investment Program are children. Almost 80,000 children a month rely on this program. And the policies you make for their parents have significant impact on those children. When parents are allowed access to training and education, it not only means that that parent has access for better paying jobs and more productive jobs, but it means that the children themselves, according to studies contracted by the federal government in the 90s, that show that the children themselves will show up at school more ready to learn and will succeed in school. When we help the parents move out of poverty, we help children move out of poverty. When we allow families to remain in the chaos of poverty, we are sending children to school unready to learn. We're sending them to our child welfare system. We're sending them to our juvenile delinquency system. So as you look at specific policies, we ask you to think of the major ramifications, not only in the adults' lives, but in the children's lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hood. Thank you. The next two will have Carrie Thomas and Bernie Hess.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I do have my testimony to hand out because I'm going to keep it relatively short. My name is Carrie Thomas, and I'm the policy director with the Jobs Now Coalition. And we're a coalition that's a statewide coalition of over 100 organizations. We do research and advocacy on employment and economic issues that affect low-wage, unemployed, underemployed, and dislocated workers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 154. At Jobs Now, we believe that both private employment decisions and public policies that promote employment and labor market attachment should be grounded in relevant local labor market information. To that end, I've included with my testimony some local labor market information, some that we produce and some that we put together from state agencies. And I'm not going to go through it now. My contact information is there if you have any questions. But I'd like to comment on this bill in particular. We've always maintained that first and foremost, people should be able to find solutions to their economic problems in the labor market. We also know that many families face economic hardship, sudden loss of income, huge costs due to sudden health problems, or simply a poor labor market, recession, a lot of low-wage jobs and inability, jobs that are too far away. So they turn to services from programs such as the Minnesota Family Investment Program. This program was intended to provide income support to the poorest children and their parents, to help parents get into the labor market and get ahead, not fall behind. In recent years, as you've heard, the program has focused on work in order to meet government requirements rather than work and jobs that support families. Often, policies have little to do with the labor market conditions that job seekers face, and we support Senate File 154 and point to three provisions that strengthen the components of the program that help families attach to the labor market. First, we support prohibiting unpaid work. There is no evidence that unpaid work or workfare is a successful labor market attachment strategy. It is intended to help meet government requirements cheaply rather than to help individuals gain skills, work experience, or decent-paying jobs. There are models of paid work experience, also known as transitional jobs or supported work, that pay participants a paycheck for their work. A paycheck is the value of the job. With it, an individual is treated with respect like every other worker, can earn Social Security quarters, and take advantage of tax policies for working families. Second, we know that for some MFIP parents, skills training and education will make the difference between a series of dead-end, short-term, low-wage jobs and a path to a decent-paying job. We strongly support policies in the MFIP program that allow participants to get education or skills training that will put them on the path to a good-paying job. Third, we support returning the eligibility of the Child Care Assistance Program to 75% of state median income. The Child Care Assistance Programs have been a key source of support for all low-income working families and help parents who struggle in low-wage jobs to stay off of MFIP. This policy change in this bill will improve the program to support all low-income working parents and eliminate the need to turn to MFIP in order to pay for child care. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and I take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the MFIP program. What can you just briefly describe the education and skills training part of that program? Is there a component to that? They have to get involved, sign up for it, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, there's very little left of the education or training portion of the original MFIP program. The original program, when it was in its pilot phase, had a lot of education and training. Many people in the program were in education and training, and it did have a beneficial effect. But not only were the cuts that we talk about in this bill today imposed in 2003, but also the funds that are available to the counties to provide services to clients were cut as well. And so there's been less and less referring people to education and training programs. As I said earlier, I will have another bill dealing with the compliance issue, and in that bill we'll be trying to address that concern.
Thank you. Mr. Hess?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. I am Bernie Hess. I am with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. I'm an organizer. We are a union that represents 5,000 workers in the East Metro and retail. We stand in support of Senate File 154. I realize brevity at this point is probably appreciated. We believe in making work pay. We are very concerned about MFIP recipients being pushed into jobs that don't pay a living wage, offer no career ladder, and thrive on high turnover. And by that, I'll just give you an example. You may or may not know that our union is doing a public education campaign around Walmart's. One thing we have found out is there's a 60% turnover in some of their stores right now. So we see this welfare to work program as a potential pipeline for them to get labor at almost no cost at all. With the average wage in retail is about $7.29 an hour right now. That's a medium wage in Minnesota, whereas the average grocery store worker in the metro who's unionized makes $13 an hour. So we're in competition now with these mega retailers, and we were just wondering out loud, how low is this going to go when it comes to wages? We're not interested in matching their wages. We've looked over in Wisconsin, where you may have heard of the W-2 program, where folks are moved on to work, and you know why we support real jobs in that. What we have found is the number of those folks, or the average folks over there, have been pushed into jobs that pay about $12,000 a year. It's hardly an income to live on or support a family. So we stand in support of lifting folks up and getting them into real jobs, but we really see the whole idea of pushing people into the private sector, and I think that's something that is within the realm as a threat to our workers who are making living wages and providing for their families. So we stand in support of Senate File 154, and we are going to continue to stand up for working people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Thank you both. Next we have, and we have several more witnesses, and I'd like to see if we can take action on the bill today. Jessica Webster and Al Hester.
My name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid, and Legal Aid provides free legal assistance to low-income Minnesotans and senior citizens, regardless of income. Last year, we served 35,000 low-income people, and we know there are more than 500,000 people who are eligible in Minnesota. Today, I'd like to make 2 points, and I'll try to make them briefly. Legal Aid knows that the 2005 Deficit Reduction Act and the new TANF regs have provided a really significant new challenge for the state. And as you've heard, if we do not come up with innovative and effective policy proposals to address the federal work participation rate, we will not meet it. We will face significant penalties to our TANF block grant. I believe upwards of $26 million coming in 2008 and 2009. So we understand the position that the state is in right now. And as such, with that new challenge, there's going to be tremendous pressure on to put MFIT participants into activities that count toward the federal work participation rate. And one of those activities is going to be unpaid work. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on unpaid work provision in this this bill because you have heard some eloquent testimony about it. But I can tell you that, unfortunately, legal aid's experiences and our clients' experiences with unpaid work have not been particularly positive in all cases. Oftentimes, these unpaid work experiences should be paid. We've had clients who have been required to volunteer to vacuum county buildings, to rake gravel parking lots, to pick up trash on highways. And as you can tell, arguably those positions should be paid. But number two, those types of positions are not necessarily moving people toward being more employable down the road once they leave that volunteer position. These positions oftentimes don't turn into paid positions, as you've heard before. And, you know, we also think that if a participant is able to rake a gravel parking lot or vacuum a county building or do clerical tasks in a nonprofit, we think that that person is probably capable of doing paid employment and that a job counselor should work maybe a little bit more diligently with that participant to find them paid a paid position. Many MFIP participants who are not able to find are facing really significant barriers to employment. And as Senator Berglund mentioned, we have many families who have undiagnosed disabilities and other barriers, perhaps mental illness, perhaps chemical dependency, perhaps multiple significant barriers to finding paid employment. And so if you take a mom who hasn't been able to find a job, cannot read the back of the macaroni and cheese box, cannot make change for the bus, has maybe not showered in a couple weeks because she's clinically depressed, it's not going to make a lot of sense for a job counselor to take that mom and force her to or require her to get into an unpaid volunteer employment experience because she has a lot of issues that she needs to address within her family and we need to stabilize her family first before looking at the work component. And we will talk about that more this session and about all of the vulnerable families that are on MFIP that perhaps need different types of services. My second point, which is more brief, is that though Minnesota is facing this really significant challenge, we think the state can meet it, and we think the state can meet it head on. We think that there are funds to meet this challenge. We know that there are innovative and effective proposals that can be brought to the table to help meet the federal participation rate. And if there is funding left over after we address this federal challenge, we absolutely support restoring some of the cuts that were made to MFIP in 2003, namely the $50 housing penalty, the SSI penalty, and the family cap. And that concludes my testimony. I can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Mr. Hester, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Al Hester. I'm an employee of the St. Paul Public Housing Agency, but I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of NARO. That's the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, which includes most of the housing authorities across the state. There are 144 housing authorities operating federally subsidized housing programs in over 200 communities. And I'd like to talk very briefly about a narrow impact of the $50 MFIP housing penalty, which you've already heard about today. It was introduced with the 1997 Welfare Reform Act, not as a wonderful policy idea, but to save money. It was really all about the money. Nobody said at the time, you know, we could help cover the MFIP costs if we took money away from affordable housing. But that was one of the unintended consequences, because federal law determines how much a person living in public housing or receiving Section 8 help pays for rent. If their income goes down, whether from an MFIP cut or some other reason, then their rent payment goes down some too. So the net effect has been to pull current figures we think are about $1.3 million a year out of the money available for affordable housing programs in the state. Now, that has two different kinds of effects. Our housing agencies run both public housing, where we own the property, where the landlords, and then we handle the Section 8 subsidies that are paid to private property owners. On the Section 8 side, it's a closed system. If a subsidy costs more, we just can't issue as many vouchers. We have an estimate of how many vouchers that may mean. It's not, somebody could pass those around for you to have just your materials. It's not a huge number of vouchers. It may be 150 statewide right now. The numbers aren't real firm, but that's 150 families that aren't getting that deep housing subsidy that would be available otherwise. Why? Because Minnesota has reduced the amount of money available to the housing programs. On the public housing side, we can't save money by cutting units, although some of our agencies are looking at selling off public housing because the federal funding cuts are so severe right now. But for the most part, month to month, we simply have to make do with less income. There's less money for maintenance. There's less money for management. And it's not only the MFIP recipients themselves who are living in that housing. 60% of the families living, or the households living in public housing in St. Paul are headed by an elderly or disabled person. So some of the target groups we most want to help we're taking money away from. This is a year where the state is looking at putting a lot more money into affordable housing, and we think that's great. We see this as an opportunity to plug a $1.3 million leak that's been coming out of the affordable housing system. There are other policy reasons, better workforce attachment, things like that, that have been shown by the studies. But mostly I just want to highlight this cost to the affordable housing system. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have
any. Thank you, Mr. Hester. So there's 150 households losing it because of the cuts you've had. That's including the Minneapolis and St. Paul numbers?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is the biggest. That's a good question. The need for affordable housing is huge. It's a little hard to measure. In St. Paul, the public housing waiting list alone is over 6,000 households, and I just got a memo before I left saying that we're going to even cut off the waiting list. Our Section 8 waiting list has been cut off since November of 2002. You can't even apply since then. And that's typical through most of the housing agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Hester. We do have three more witnesses who wanted to testify. I hope they can be very brief, all of them on child care. Ann Kaner-Roth, Carol Spector, and Eric Helge. Go ahead in whatever order you wish.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ann Kaner-Roth, and I'm the executive director of Child Care Works. And we are a statewide coalition that works on child care public policy, and we have many different partners that we work with, and some of those partners are represented here today. I'm going to be very brief, and I'm going to speak on behalf of this panel, but we did want to show the broad support that there is for a particular provision in this bill. And I'll introduce the folks that are up here quickly. To my right, Valerie Doeslin represents the Minnesota Child Care Association. Carol Spector is here on behalf of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. And Eric Haugy is here for Ready for K. And all four of these organizations strongly support this bill. And we are here to testify in support specifically for Section 1 on the bill, which increases child care assistance eligibility. And we thank Senator Berglund for bringing this forward. Minnesota was once a leader in allowing access to child care for low-income families. But in 2003, the state dropped income eligibility to 175% of the federal poverty guidelines. That brought Minnesota's ranking in allowing access to child care from fourth in the nation to 42nd in the nation. We have dropped considerably in that type of status. This bill asks for the eligibility for the child care assistance program to be restored to 75% of the state median income, which is recommended by the federal guidelines that operate these programs nationwide. All of our organizations strongly support this provision. For some context, a family of three, usually a single mom and two children, is not eligible for child care assistance if their annual income is above $29,000, unless they started receiving help at an even lower income. Full-time child care in Minnesota for those two children runs on average $20,000 a year. Child care assistance is no longer structured in a way that helps families reach self-sufficiency. This bill will help to bring the child care assistance program back to being more functional for families. And in short, we urge your support of this provision, and we're glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Kaner-Roth. Questions from the committee? If not, none of the rest of you need to add anything. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to thank everyone who came today to testify, and I'd like to thank all of you who have had the patience to sit and listen.
And with that, I would move that Senate File 154 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Is there a discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
Pretty good.